Ring the bell, sucker.
This is Movie Fighters, the show where Chris Sims and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and we beat them up. Last episode, when we watched Masters of the Universe, we had some discussion about what we should do next. We asked about doing more Mattel movies. We talked about doing more Dolph Lundgren movies. We also talked about continuing the canon. Yes, all your favorite canon films. Now, what ended up happening was I ended up posting a poll on Twitter because we seem to have the most interest about either Dolph Lundgren or canon. The poll was a virtual tie.
So close. It was too close to call.
I think canon actually ended up winning slightly. So we probably will end up doing some more canon movies in the coming episodes. But we felt like the right call for our third episode in March was to watch the Dolph Lundgren starring Punisher movie from 1989, not actually released in the United States until 1991, direct to video, because the Punisher is so prominent in the new second season of Daredevil.
It's topical. It's relevant, sort of. Highly, certain values of topical.
Highly relevant. Also of interest is just to look at this movie in light of where Marvel properties were in terms of their movie status, you know, not really that long ago, about 27 years ago compared to now. Because surprisingly enough, this is not a canon film. This is
It feels like it should be.
It really does. Not to mention that canon had the rights to some other Marvel characters, notably Spider-Man at the time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But the Punisher was distributed by New World Pictures. Now, this movie was supposed to be released as a theatrical release in 1989. It was released worldwide, theatrically, everywhere except for the United States, Sweden, and South Africa. It was supposed to be released in the United States in August 1989, but New World Films went under.
Yeah.
Therefore, the movie just had to be released on VHS and Laserdisc in 1991. My brother had a VHS copy of this, which I looked at a lot, but never actually pulled out and watched all the way through. I think I maybe watched like the first 15 minutes of it and couldn't actually watch the rest, because it was one of those things where I would like – I couldn't like ask my brother to watch The Punisher. I would just have to like go in his room and like look at the VHS box. And if I got the opportunity, like pop it in the VCR to see a little bit of it before he noticed that I was watching it.
You've not seen this movie.
Not all the way through. Never.
Okay. I actually have seen this movie. And I bought this movie relatively recently because it was released on DVD probably within the past 10 years, I think. I mean, it has the menu screen that looks like the first DVD. If you go to moviefighters.tumblr.com, that's the first thing I've put up there in a while. But it looks like it is literally the first time they were like, oh, we can do a menu screen.
Yeah,
and this is what they came up with.
It's very much the special features list on the back of the DVD box being animated menus.
Yeah, I have my Die Hard DVD is like that. But I watched this movie probably – I mean, I watched it when I got it on DVD, and I have to say, I'm a Punisher fan. I've seen all the Punisher movies. I have fallen a little bit behind, but up through probably 2014, I have read all the Punisher comics. I have read every Punisher comic, every Marvel original graphic novel, every miniseries, all 10 of the ongoing series that he's had. I've read them all. And so I've also seen all the Punisher movies. In my estimation, this is actually the best Punisher movie.
Better than the 2004 Punisher movie starring Thomas Jane. Better than Punisher Warzone. Better than Are those the only Punisher movies that have been made since?
There's only three Punisher movies. What those two movies have going for them is that both Tom Jane and Ray Stevenson, who plays Punisher in Punisher Warzone, are very good Frank Castles. The current Daredevil show that's on Netflix, Daredevil Season 2, which I've also watched. I've watched the Punisher arc, so Elektra just showed up, so we're into Elektra now. All the stuff with Punisher in that series has been very good as well, and he's a very good Punisher. But those two movies, despite having people that I think could do really well in the role, those movies are not good. Warzone, I think, is more entertaining because it goes way over the top. It's got Jigsaw in it.
Yeah, it's got that goofy ass Jigsaw in it.
Yeah, the Jigsaw and Looney Bin Jim. And it takes like some weird stuff from the Ennis run. Like it takes lines from the Ennis run, which both of those Punisher movies do. Like all three of the 21st century Punisher projects, Daredevil Season 2 and those two movies, are very heavily influenced by the Ennis run, which makes sense because Ennis wrote the Punisher for 10 years and kind of rescued him from being a D-lister. Like Punisher went through this huge popularity in the 80s and 90s. And then dropped.
Yeah, I feel like, the Punisher was one of those characters that, by all indications, was just going to be sort of a time capsule character. Like, he had his moment of popularity, mm-hmm. and then he kind of wasn't relevant anymore. And Garth Ennis single-handedly made him relevant.
Well, Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon and...
And all the artists involved, of course. Steve Dillon, yeah. Probably more than anybody else, but certainly, you know, the Garth Ennis run on Punisher revitalized that character into something relevant again. And interesting enough, held on to all the Vietnam stuff, which
made Punisher a 70-year-old man.
Yeah, which all the adaptations have not held on to. Since we're talking about Daredevil Season 2, I think. Part of what makes Punisher really work in that show is how he is introduced as an adversary, much like the way he was introduced in the comics. You know, he showed up in Spider-Man as basically a hired killer, right?
Yeah. So, Matt, were you disappointed that the Jackal didn't show up in Daredevil Season 2?
Let's keep your fingers crossed for Season 3.
That Miles Warren didn't make his appearance as a weird little green werewolf?
Who makes clones? I think introducing the Punisher as an adversary, because he is such a different kind of anti-hero, you know, a guy who kills people. It's hard to get into his head as a protagonist, you know, even if you tell the sympathetic story about his family. So I feel like that approach really works, and that may be why, you know, the movie attempts to do the Punisher haven't worked, where he is the lead character and he's supposed to be the guy you sympathize with, you know?
I feel like Punisher runs into the same problem that, oddly enough, that Jonah Hex has, where what makes Jonah Hex cool in the comics, aside from the fact that Jonah Hex is a cool visual, you know, he's got the weird face,
the melted half of his face. Yeah.
Yeah. He's Western Two-Face. But, you know, he's a Western anti-hero, which comics did not have when Jonah Hex was introduced. So in comics, he was revelatory. In movies, you have that in the 60s. You have that in A Fistful of Dollars.
Right.
You have Clint Eastwood. All due respect, you're never going to make a Jonah Hex movie that is as good as For a Few Dollars More. You're never going to make a Jonah Hex movie that's as good as The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Sorry. Sorry. I hate to be the one to break it to you. Those movies are very good. You might make a samurai movie that's as good as For a Few Dollars More. In fact, that has happened.
Yeah, it actually came out before it.
Actually came out first. Yes.
Yeah.
Punisher is the same way in that in comics, he works because he's such a diametric opposite to the prevailing superhero style. You're never going to have a Spider-Man who kills people. You know, Daredevil is not going to go out looking for blood because of the way comics are set up, because of the way superheroes are set up, because you don't want to to kill off your villains that are super fun. And if you do, you're going to bring them back. Like, in a world where, you know, Bullseye can come back from the dead, any number of characters can come back from the dead, Punisher has to be very frustrated. Punisher has to be... There's got to be some guy who just got retconned back to life and was like, I need to move and change my name before the Punisher finds me again.
The Punisher, as he was introduced in the 1970s, is pretty clearly a comics way of introducing stuff from the movies of the 1970s, particularly like your Death Wish kinds of movies.
Yeah, he's Charles Bronson.
Yeah.
He's Death Wish. And Death Wish 3 is basically a Garth Ennis Punisher movie. If you've never seen Death Wish 3, it's bananas. We should watch Death Wish 3, because I think that's a canon film.
All right, we'll think about it. That's one to put on the bill. But yeah, like, the Punisher was an attempt to put sort of the movies of the time into comics. So anything that you do with him in movies is going to not be that original. It's going to seem a little repetitive compared to what we've seen in movies before.
Yeah, exactly. So if you don't kind of embrace that comic bookiness, if you don't go with – if you don't introduce a larger context for him, then you do either what the Tom Jane Punisher did, which is you just kind of make a sort of weak Death Wish ripoff with John Travolta for some reason. Although that movie does have the amazing scene where Punisher blows up a bunch of cars and they make the Punisher skull when viewed from above, which is you know that part in the Daredevil movie where Daredevil draws a DD in gas and then like 4 hours later Ben Urich throws his cigarette on it and it bursts into flames? Like how long term was that planning? Like, the cars forming the Punisher logo that can only be viewed from low-flying helicopters is even better. So you either do that, which is you create kind of a weak sauce ripoff, or you do what Warzone did, which is you put Punisher in this bonkers, you know, context, but you don't, you know, they didn't go all the way with it. That movie still tries to be grounded and realistic. Like, it doesn't go... It goes too far in spots, and then it doesn't go far enough in other spots. Like, it's uneven, I think, is the big problem with that. This movie goes super far. It goes far in every direction. And I swear to God, as someone who read the entire Mike Baron run on Punisher, this movie feels like that comic more than any other Punisher project. It doesn't necessarily feel like the Punisher as we know him now, because it doesn't feel like a post-Garth Ennis Punisher. It doesn't feel like a post-90s Punisher. It doesn't even really feel like a Chuck Dixon, John Romita Jr. Punisher. This movie feels like Punisher in 1989, because he fucking fights ninjas. And that is what the Punisher did, I assure you, in 1988 and 1989.
Before we get into watching this movie, I want to note a couple of things. One is the director, whose name is Mark Goldblatt, who most of his film career, he has been an editor. You want to hear some of the movies he's edited, Chris?
I would love to, Matt.
Piranha, Enter the Ninja, The Howling. He's basically edited every Joe Dante movie.
So this is canon adjacent.
It is very canon adjacent. I don't guess he's edited Gremlins, but he edited Halloween 2. He edited The Terminator. He edited Commando. He edited
Commando's a good one.
He edited Nightbreed. He edited
Clive Barker's Nightbreed.
Yeah, he edited Super Mario Brothers, the movie. He's the editor of Showgirls, of Hollow Man, of, weirdly enough, Pearl Harbor. And here's one you're going to really like, Chris. Triple X State of the Union he edited.
Wow, this guy should be in the Movie Fighters Hall of Fame whenever we finally build the physical Movie Fighters Hall of Fame.
The Hall of Fame restaurant? He's directed two films.
Mm-hmm.
This one, The Punisher. And another one that we've actually been asked to watch. Dead Heat, starring Treat Williams and Joe Piscopo. Ooh. Those are his two films.
That's exciting.
Yes.
I'm glad that we're getting someone who did work on what is arguably the most famous non-Masters of the Universe, non-Chuck Norris-related canon film, which I guess would probably be, like, what, Superman 3? but Enter the Ninja is kind of, like, that's, when I think of canon films, that is the film I think of.
Yeah, that may be the one we end up watching next. But here's another thing I need to note before we get into this. Movie Fighter's favorite, Lou Gossett Jr.
Yes! Javi!
Has a big role in this movie. And I am excited about that. All right, Chris, we're going to get into watching this, but before we do, it's time for our snack situation.
Oh, let's do it, bro. You love to fight with something to eat. Sometimes it's savory, sometimes it's sweet. Snack
situation. What you snacking on? All right, Chris, what are you snacking on?
Well, Matt, I have what I would describe as a plethora of snacks. I am snacked up at the moment. First of all, we are recording this on a beautiful, overcast Easter Saturday. It is Priester, as I like to call it.
Easter
is good. So that, you know what that means, Matt? It is Starburst jelly bean season.
That is true. It is that indeed.
So if you can hear that, that is a soup bowl full of Starburst jelly beans fave reds. Love the fave reds. Now, I also, however, in case I want something a little savory, I have my latest Japan Crate. They really ought to sponsor this show. Just putting that out there. Japan Crate should sponsor this show. And in this Japan Crate, I've got a couple of different options. I've got some Umaibo, which is a Japanese snack that currently features Doraemon on the label. And if you missed my review of my first Japan Crate that I wrote for Comics Alliance, it is basically a single giant Cheeto in various flavors. It is literally like a 4-inch long, about the diameter of maybe a little bigger than a quarter. It is a Cheeto that large, and you just snack on it. It's great. I am not sure what flavors I have. I think I've got nori, which I believe is seaweed. But I am very excited about maybe diving into some of these as the movie goes on. Matt, what are you snacking on today?
We're recording this a little earlier than normal in the day. We are right after lunch. So I have just finished lunching on a number one snacks combo from Zaxby's. That's right.
Ooh, Zax Snacks.
I went to Zaxby's because, listen, I like their sweet tea. That's the main reason I ever go there. But so now I'm desserting, right? I'm having some dessert. And what I've chosen for dessert is a smooth caramel galaxy bar from the Caramel Collection. This is a European, in fact, a UK candy bar. Typically, when I was over there, what I really got into was the salted caramel. But you can't get that here at World Market. You can only get the regular caramel galaxy bar. So that's what I have. I have it. You can break it into pieces and eat it. So I will be breaking off some pieces of this candy bar and eating it while we watch The Punisher. You can watch along with us. You could go buy it on DVD. It's probably not that expensive on DVD right now.
Probably not.
So you can choose to watch it with us or not. Either way, we will be back after this break and a musical interlude. And then we will talk about the movie. All right, we are back from watching Punisher 89.
That movie's pretty rad, right? Like, it's very VHS action movie.
Very VHS action movie. Because at one point, I described it as just a way to get the Punisher, Frank Castle, from set piece to set piece, and every set piece is increasingly more 80s.
Yes. But the thing people don't realize when they talk about this movie, or maybe don't take into account, because this was happening even in the letters pages of Punisher comics in, you know, 91 and 92, like, the Punisher comics of the late 80s are this movie. Like, it's just one weird VHS-style action piece after another with just some laconic first-person narration. Like, there is an arc that is just stone cold. The Brian Bosworth movie where he is an undercover cop as a biker. there is an arc that's just Class of 1984, but with Frank Castle going undercover as a substitute teacher. Like, that's all it is for about 50 issues. So, like, for me, when I say this is the best Punisher movie, it's certainly the one that I think is most faithful to the comics.
Certainly the comics of the era.
Yeah, the only thing it doesn't have is Dolph Lundgren's t-shirt having a skull on it. That's the only thing it's missing, and that would not be out of place in this movie. Because this movie is very over the top in that same kind of VHS action movie filtered through comics sort of way. Like, it's filtered back into a VHS action movie. It's great. I really like it.
It also has one big change to Frank Castle as a character, which probably didn't matter that much in 1989, but matters a lot more in a post-Garth Ennis Punisher era, which is that he's not a veteran. At least that's not mentioned. He's an ex-cop.
Yeah, which is something that you get occasionally. You get that in a lot of alternate takes on Frank Castle. Like, Brian Bendis, when he did Ultimate Punisher in Ultimate Team Up, he was a cop there, too.
Yeah. Because frankly, like, the Punisher doesn't have the same impact if he's not a Vietnam vet. For the longest time, I think there were attempts to make him a Gulf War vet, like a 1990 Gulf War vet, and that just didn't work at all. Currently, making him an Iraq War vet or an Afghanistan War vet works better.
Yeah, we've had that conversation with Greg Rucka on War Rocket Ajax, where, obviously Vietnam is intrinsic to the way Ennis writes The Punisher. Like, his last story arc on Punisher Max was as much a Vietnam story, Valley Forge, was as much a Vietnam story as it was a Punisher story.
Yeah, and Fury miniseries. Mm-hmm. That basically argues that the Punisher was made by Vietnam, not by his family being killed.
Yeah. And Greg Rucka's take was that the war itself doesn't matter as much as the idea of Frank Castle going off to protect this idea back home and then coming back, having served, having seen what he sees, having done what he does elsewhere. Whether it's in Vietnam, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan, like, being a part of that in the name of protecting America and this American dream, and then coming back and having his American dream taken from him. I do think you lose a little bit by taking the veteran aspect away from Frank Castle. And, I mean, honestly, it's a lot easier to sympathize with a traumatized veteran than it is a cop who goes rogue. Here in 2016, I think that's fair.
That is very fair, yes.
But also, it barely matters because we only see that in two scenes, which is something that I really like about this movie. It's not a Punisher origin. You get just enough origin in it to make the movie work.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a character-driven movie. It is, we see a news report at the very beginning that describes who Frank Castle is, that he's an ex-cop whose family was killed by gangsters. And then we get one flashback scene where his family get killed in a car explosion. There's back-to-back scenes right at the beginning of this movie where Frank Castle gets caught in explosions and is fine. Because
yes.
We see the car explode and he's standing right next to it tapping on the window. And just before that, he is in a mobster's house while it explodes because he blew it up. And he's seemingly inside the building while it's exploding, but then he's fine.
As a Punisher guy, I do think that it's not quite as important as Batman's family being killed by guns. But I feel like, first of all, that the Punisher's family dying, not because someone's coming after Frank Castle, but because of just the existence of crime. Like, they stumble upon crime at a picnic that they're having in Central Park, and that's how they die in the comics. I feel like that's important because it makes it personal for Frank and impersonal for everyone he's coming after. Like, there's, you know, there's no, they are not trying to get at Frank when his family dies. I think that's kind of important.
It makes Frank Castle's vendetta against crime in general and not a specific assailant.
This is kind of the thing we ran into with the RoboCop remake, you know? It's viscerally important, I think, for there to be guns involved as opposed to explosions. Like, I think it's important for, you know, Clarence Boddicker to be face-to-face with Alex Murphy in RoboCop and, you know, shooting him with a gun as opposed to just blowing him up with a car bomb, which is what happened in that RoboCop remake. Same thing here. But neither of those things is prominent enough in this movie or prominent enough really in the way Frank Castle is presented in this movie to break the character in a way that I feel like a lot of movies that go about changing the origin in minor, you know, seemingly minor but ultimately significant ways do. I don't think this movie breaks Frank Castle as a character.
No, it also isn't very interested in Frank Castle as a character. Frank Castle, we talked about for a few dollars more. We talked about The Man with No Name. We sort of tangentially talked about Yojimbo. That's kind of what he is in this movie.
He's a very Ennis-style character in a very Mike Barron-style world.
Yes, he's a kind of involved in things that don't have a lot to do with him. You know what I mean? Like, he's a character who pushes things along in this movie, but he doesn't really drive a whole lot of the action himself. The only character who's really reacting to him is Lou Gossett Jr., who is Frank Castle's ex-partner, Jake Berkowitz, which is an interesting name to give a Louis Gossett Jr. character.
Yes, it is. But yeah, like, in the way that Ennis's Punisher, you know, Punisher Max is something that I've described before as a book that where every arc is divided into two halves. The first three issues are about the crooks. They're about the criminals. They're about the people who need to die. And then the second three issues are about Punisher killing all those people. Like, it's a very formulaic approach that works because, you know, there's always new crimes and it's very procedural in a way. And that's what this movie is. We don't really see things exclusively from the Punisher's point of view. We see a lot of stuff from the point of view of the crooks throughout the movie. There's the driving force of the movie is an inter-gang conflict. It's a conflict between the Yakuza and the Italian mafia? The Dutch mafia?
The character's name is Gianni Franco.
Yeah.
But the actor is Jerome Krabbe. He's Dutch. And you may remember him from so many movies in the 80s where he had to play a Eurotrash guy.
Super Eurotrash.
But I think mainly you might know him from the James Bond movie The Living Daylights, the first Timothy Dalton James Bond movie.
No, that's not the one with Benicio del Toro. That's License to Kill, where Benicio del Toro says, "Have a good honeymoon."
Yeah, that's License to Kill, I believe. So let's run through the set pieces because I think those are the most important part of the movie, and I wanna show all the different locations where various shootings occur throughout the movie and just how 80s they are.
But before that, can I give you the kill count in this movie?
Please do. Well, this is the Frank Castle kill count. There are more deaths in the movie, but this is everybody that Frank Castle kills.
These are all the kills that we can attribute directly to Frank Castle. And I will say this number's a little fuzzy because there are a couple of scenes where Frank teams up with the Eurotrash mobster and they kind of simultaneously mow down a room full of guys. So we basically just chop the number in half for those scenes. But the number we came away with was 44. Frank Castle kills 44 people over the course of this movie. At one point, he is wanted. When he is arrested, they say that he's going to be brought up on 125 first-degree murder charges, which, again, given that he kills 44 people in this movie, seems a little low.
Yeah, those are the only ones they could get evidence on, I guess, right?
Now there is also There is also a murder committed by two children.
This is true.
Throw a man off a bus and under the tracks of or under the tires of a pursuing car. That is not one of Frank's, but I do feel like it is worth mentioning.
And that's not really first degree. That's like second degree at highest, probably manslaughter.
Oh, I think they could. I think they could easily get off. That guy was trying to sell them into child slavery.
That is
so.
And we'll get into that plot point in a little bit. But
all right, so let's go through the set pieces.
The first one is in the mobster's house.
Right. The mobster who has a hall of mirrors in his house.
Yes, that is true. This is a mobster that we see at the very beginning of the movie. He has been on trial and he has somehow, through some kind of chicanery, has gotten off.
Yeah, he's the Dapper Don.
He reminds me of so many like 80s actors, but I can't quite put my finger on who. Maybe the guy from Evening Shade.
He looks kind of like a thicker Jerry Orbach.
Yeah, not Evening Shade. I was thinking of Empty Nest, the guy from Empty Nest. He's kind of got that look to him.
Yeah, fair.
I don't know why I said Evening Shade. Maybe I have Burt Reynolds on the brain. But
he does not look like Burt Reynolds at all.
That's the first big set piece in this mobster's house. And one hilarious detail of the movie is it's pretty much supposed to be set in New York, even though the name of the city is never mentioned, and all the police cars just say state police on them.
They have super legit state police stickers on the doors. They look very official.
The bus that Frank Castle steals at one point just says, like, Metro Transit on it. There's no city ever mentioned. But one of the very first shots of the movie is of what's supposed to be this New York City courtroom. All these reporters are interviewing this gangster. And then just off to the right is a whole bunch of palm trees because this movie was made in Australia. It was made in Sydney.
Yeah.
So they're trying throughout to hide that this is Australia, but immediately do a very bad job of it.
Right. So we get this. Frank goes through the mansion, and it's actually kind of cool because it's like a horror movie compressed to about 3 minutes.
He stabs a guy. Yeah. He hangs a guy. He doesn't like.
He kicked one dude off the stairs.
Yeah, like not that far off, but the guy immediately dies. One thing that's really noticeable about the Frank Castle in this movie is, of course, he uses guns. He's a big gun guy. But he is way more into knives than comics Frank Castle ever was.
Yeah, that's a weird thing that comes through in a lot of adaptations. I know when, like, I read all those Punisher comics because I played that, 2006-ish PlayStation 2 Punisher game that Tom Jane did the voice for, 2005 maybe?
Yeah.
And, like, when you fill up his limit break meter in that, he puts his gun away and pulls out knives. And like every time you, like, the screen turns red and Tom Jane goes, "It's punishment." And he starts like throwing knives at dudes instead of shooting them, which is weird because he has like a machine gun, which you would think would be more efficient. But no, like non-comics media loves Punisher with knives.
In this movie, the knives are basically his calling card.
Yeah, which I think is why they do it, because it gets the skull in there without having it be, you know, a Superman logo on his chest. But it also is like, Frank Castle has like a crate of those knives down in the sewers.
Yeah, like, it's this knife, this long knife with a skull on the end of the handle. So it's a way for him to say, like, hey, I committed this murder, I'm the Punisher. Okay, so
maybe it's just 125 people that have been killed with those skull knives.
That's how they knew to charge him. That's how they knew. After the mobster's house, the next set piece is at a dock. Is at the docks because Frank is told that this is where a drug shipment is coming in. He kills a bunch of people at the dock. Then we get mega 80s with the next set piece because the next set piece is at an old abandoned amusement park full of slides that the mobsters that he kills, like, come in on. They, like, slide down the slides. And it's full of
so fucking great.
And it's full of arcade machines. The set piece after that – now, there's got to be another set piece between that and Oh, I guess the next set piece is on the bus, right? He goes and saves a bunch of kids in a dank warehouse, and then there's a bus ride. And then the final set piece is at the top of a tall skyscraper. 80s.
Super 80s.
And then inside that top floor of the tall skyscraper is a fully, Japanese-style pagoda with paper walls. And samurais in there.
Yeah. Which I think has been redesigned from when it was a weird Batman 89 Art Deco, possibly the Vatican mob stronghold with Star Trek doors and a crucifix on the mantle.
Yeah, that's a different set, which weirdly enough, Frank doesn't go to at any point. Lou Gossett does, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, Frank is never on that set, but that's a Super 80 set with the mega 80s boardroom, but then there's all this religious imagery around, I guess to make it look like the mafia is Italian, because there's a crucifix.
There's a crucifix, but there's also the Birth of Venus.
Yeah.
Just in a little alcove. Or not the Birth of Venus, the Venus de Milo.
And then to cap off how 80s everything is, 80s/early 90s, Frank's base of operations, even though I think we confirmed it in our discussion, it's never been this in the comics. It's always been some kind of warehouse or an apartment in a shitty building or something like that.
Yeah.
In this movie, Frank Castle's base of operations is a sewer. He's literally a ninja underground. Turtle.
Yes. This movie is there's pizza in this movie and there's sewers in this movie, so...
Could it be any more 1989?
No. The best part of that is that Frank is able to elude detection and move around the city freely by riding a motorcycle through the sewers. The very clean sewers. They're not sewers. They're maintenance tunnels for the city. It looks like he's in a stadium.
Yeah.
Trying to find the bathroom in a stadium.
There's no liquid. There's no liquid running around through the sewers. It's just dry.
It's a great place for Frank to do his naked meditation.
Which we see the same shot of three times.
We see the footage of his bare ass. It was awesome.
We see it once at the very beginning. We see it once at the very end. And then it's in the opening credits, too. And I feel like, Chris, we should talk about this opening credit sequence for a little while.
I describe the opening credit sequence as being not too different from the Batman 66 opening credits sequence. You know, the not the TV show, but the movie where it's all those neon lit shots of criminals running through the streets and then Batman coming onto the screen. If you're familiar with that, imagine that, but with the Punisher. And that is exactly what we have here.
It's all these concentric circles that make it look like a target, which is kind of neat. And then within the circles are criminals. But it also reminds me of this, and I want to say it's Logan's Run, but I'm pretty sure it's not Logan's Run. But there was an old sci-fi TV series in the 80s or the 90s or the 70s, I mean, that used that same concentric circle motif. And I'm kicking myself for not remembering what sci-fi series that was, but it looks like that.
It does feel like the credits to the opening sequence of an NBC drama from the early, a crime drama from the early 90s on TV, like The Equalizer.
Yeah, it absolutely has that feel to it.
I kind of love it.
It looks like it's Frank Castle doing target practice on you know how in every movie version of a police training simulation where the cutouts of people pop up and then you have to decide whether to shoot them or not, whether they're a criminal or an innocent person, that kind of target practice training. That's what it looks like, except Frank Castle shoots them all in his target practice. After Frank kills that mobster from the very beginning of the movie.
Yeah. And Frank, the Punisher is a going concern. He has been at this a while, which, again, I really like. I like that we're starting with, hey, There's a guy out there called the Punisher. He's killing criminals.
It is repeatedly stated that it's been 5 years since he left the police force. And Lou Gossett has been trying to find him for 5 years. Mm-hmm. So he's been roughly on this mission for that long. So he kills this mobster at the very beginning, which leaves a kind of a power vacuum within the organized crime community.
As much as it is a story about this inter-criminal conflict, it's also a story that Frank is the inciting incident. Like, so he's not removed from it, which, again, I think is a good choice.
Yeah. He's not removed from it, but he's not the person who's driving the action later on, because in comes Gianni Franco, the Italian quote unquote / Dutch crime boss who has arrived.
You're a hero trash.
Yeah. Who has arrived in the city and decided that now is the time for him to come in, unite all the families, and be the big power broker in the city. There's one group that does not want this to happen. That is the Japanese mafia, the Yakuza, as it's said in the movie. And there's a part where the Eurotrash gangsters are talking about the Yakuza, and Gianni Franco mentions them, and one of his associates goes, "The Yaku?"
No, he goes, "The Yaku what?"
That's it. "The Yaku what?" And Franco has to say, "The Japanese mafia."
Yeah, which I feel like if you are one of the four guys running crime in, I mean, let's just say a city, because that's where we are. Surely you've heard of the Yakuza by this point. Unless, like, this is this guy's second week and Frank has just killed everybody ahead of him, which I do believe.
Absolutely. Oh, I remember the show that it reminded me of, the opening credits of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century.
Okay.
It's got the same look as that. Go watch those opening credits on YouTube. So now we have a crime battle between the mob and the Yakuza. And they are trying to figure out different ways to eliminate each other. The Yakuza, who is led by Lady Tanaka, decides that their plan is to kidnap every European mobster's kid and hold them for ransom and push the mafia out. Mm-hmm. So they kidnap, like, what, a dozen kids?
Yeah, because they not only want to take over, they want to put, like, keep the Eurotrash guys in charge of the day-to-day, but they'll take over finance and investments. And the split they offer is 75-25. And so the mobster guys are like, "Hell no, that's ridiculous." And so they're like, "Fine, we're going to kidnap all your kids."
Including Franco's son, who we see in an earlier scene, who is kind of like, you said at one point during the movie, I can't remember if this movie, much like RoboCop 2, has a shitty evil kid in it.
Yeah.
And he is not exactly a shitty evil kid. He's kind of a good kid who is maybe becoming a shitty evil kid because of his mobster dad.
Yeah.
Throughout the movie, he is wearing a school uniform. So there's sort of an implication that he has not really been with his family. He's been off, like, in boarding school. And then there's a group of, you know, 10 or 11 other kids, all of whom are just, like, really scared kids. There's a scene where they're in a cell being guarded by the Yakuza. Lady Tanaka comes walking in, and she tries to intimidate all of them. They're actually going to take Gianni Franco's son away to put him elsewhere and keep him kind of, like, locked up separately. But, no, I guess it's Gianni Franco's kid who, like, runs over and pushes Lady Tanaka over when she tries to do something. She tries to intimidate one of the other kids,
mm-hmm.
which is supposed to show us that he's kind of, like, brave and maybe not all that bad.
Yeah.
But he also, like, physically assaults a mob boss, like a crime boss, and she doesn't do a thing about it. They just walk out of the cell and lock the door. While these kids have been kidnapped, now that these kids have been kidnapped, there's this informant that Frank has been talking to throughout the movie. His name is Shake, and he is the weirdest fucking character in the movie.
Yeah, he's... Matt, have you ever read Moon Knight?
Yes, I've read some old Moon Knight.
Yeah, well, one of Moon Knight's informants is this guy. Like, his name isn't Shakes, it's Crawley, but he's this old British actor who is now like an alcoholic on the streets. And like they clearly just lifted this straight from Moon Knight so that Frank would have someone to talk to. It's weird that they don't use, if they wanted Frank to have someone to talk to, it's weird that they don't use Micro.
Yeah,
but Micro
isn't an informant. He's a weapon maker.
Yeah. So, but I mean, honestly, I feel like Shakes is just there so that we don't only have to have first person narration from Dolph Lundgren all the time.
Yeah, and it's also, I feel like there's, much like Masters of the Universe, there's a lot of effort made in this movie to make it so that Dolph Lundgren doesn't have to talk that much.
Because he has a very thick accent. But as long as he keeps his voice low and growly and just kind of says very short sentences, he's fine.
Yeah.
I don't want to stretch this out.
It sounds like he's doing a Sliced Loan impression throughout the entire movie. I learned English from talking to Sliced Loan in Rocky IV. I must break you.
Anyway, there's this weird stuff with Shake throughout the movie where, like, this version of Frank Castle doesn't really gather information. He just has this guy, Shake, who I described as like a character from out of a Charles Dickens novel in this weird late 80s, early 90s crime movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's talking in this like almost poetic language. About half his lines rhyme.
He gives Frank a rhyming soliloquy at one point.
In the sewer.
About how they're going to kill all the kids.
Yeah, he begs Frank to go save these kids.
Which is weird, because, like, was he writing that on the way over? Or is he just freestyling?
He might have just been freestyling. But the Yakuza's plan for these kids is to sell them into slavery. That is what they're going to do. So, oh, I missed one of the set pieces. The one where Frank busts in through a stained glass window at the top of a underground casino, and he shoots alcohol bottles and slot machines for 5 minutes.
He unloads an M60, a belt-fed M60, into slot machines, and we see it in real time.
It is the most McBain scene in the movie.
It's great. It is great.
It is super McBain, because he's standing on a craps table shooting slot machines for God knows how long. But yeah, he starts attacking Yakuza-led businesses and trying to find out where the kids are being held. That's what leads him to the casino. It's what leads him to the abandoned amusement park. And it's what eventually leads him to steal a city bus, make the stops, and drop people off, then show up at a warehouse and load the kids onto a bus. And then there's a chase scene between the Yakuza and Frank, who's driving the bus. Eventually, he is stopped by a roadblock that's set up by the police, and Frank gets arrested. Like, the police take the kids, they save the kids, everybody but Franco's son, who kind of gets lost in the shuffle during the rescue. Everybody, all the other kids get taken by the police, and Frank gets arrested, which leads to an amazing scene with Dolph Lundgren in a prison cell and Lou Gossett trying to talk some sense into him in the prison.
Where Lou Gossett slap fights him.
And he says, let me in! Let me in!
It's amazing because it's just Lou Gossett like down, like crouched down next to Dolph Lundgren, just kind of pawing at his face, like aggressively pawing at his face. It's amazing.
Because what we found out throughout the movie is that Lou, Jake Berkowitz, has sort of gone inward as a cop. Like he doesn't like to work with anybody. There's a character who a female cop who I don't know if I ever got her name even. She's just kind of like a very stereotypical late 80s cop character. But she is continually trying to get Jake to open up and let her be his partner, let her investigate this Punisher case with him. And he very, very reticently allows this, but it keeps everything pretty close to the vest. Eventually, what we find out, while Berkowitz and his new partner are investigating the sewers in raincoats, which is amazing, is that he is Frank's ex-partner. They used to be partners. He feels responsible partially for letting Frank leave the force, letting Frank go on this rampage after his family was killed. He feels like he could have pulled Frank back in, but he wasn't able to achieve it. So now he blames himself for this stuff. So once we get to the scene where he's in the prison cell with Frank Castle, he is just going all out. Lou Gossett is going all the way the fuck out to try to pull Frank back in.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. But Frank isn't hearing any of it. So Berkowitz leaves the cell and he basically says, if I can't get through to you, nobody can. And he bangs on the door and he says, open this door. And he goes away. The next scene is the other cop character and Frank in a prison transport where he's being taken to, you know, whatever Supermax prison he's going to be held at. And she tells him that Jake has now resigned from the force because he feels so bad about not being able to get through to Frank. I feel like that's a scene we should have seen, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like we should have seen Jake Berkowitz angrily resigning from the force. But we're just told that in exposition just before the prison transport gets stopped and a bunch of mobsters go inside the prison transport, knock out Frank Castle, and drag him back to this, wherever Gianni Franco is at that moment, where Franco says, I am insisting that you come with me to help me save my son, who is still being held by the Yakuza.
Yeah. And Frank goes, like, Frank finally agrees to do it and then goes, after this is done, I am going to kill you. Which is a very, very Punisher-y thing to do.
This is one of two scenes where Frank is held by mobsters, by the way. Because we skipped the other one where he's held by the Yakuza and is tortured.
They put him on the rack.
They put him on, like, a weird butcher shop equivalent of a rack. And he just gets out of it by turning a screw and gets out. And there's a pretty great moment where he just grabs a mobster guy's gun out of his holster, shoots that guy in the dick, and then shoots the guy standing right next to him.
Yeah, but he doesn't. Like, I didn't count the second guy because he just shoots that guy in the dick and the other guy just falls over.
Maybe he's playing dead. Maybe he's trying to be smart. Shake is also captured in that part, but, you know, the Punisher just lets him out. So Franco and Frank, which is a weird combination of names to put together, but whatever, have a mobster Punisher team up, which might be the only time that ever happens in a Punisher story.
I'm sure that it's had to happen before. Like, there's an entire volume. I think it's the Ostrander volume where Punisher does join the mob and goes undercover and to bring them down. But there is a little bit of mob Punisher teaming up in that. But yeah, it is a rare thing.
Franco and Castle, the Punisher, go through this skyscraper, the top floor of a skyscraper, mowing down Yakuza guys.
Like, hilariously, just mowing dudes down.
And fighting samurais. Like, for real, old-fashioned, ancient samurais.
Yeah, like, just straight up. Just straight up.
Until they finally find Franco's son, whose name is Tommy. And at this point, Lady Tanaka is straight up dressed like a geisha. She is in full geisha costume, makeup, the whole deal.
Yeah, like full on. Like they're like, hey, have we had enough stereotypes in this movie yet? Like, should we hit it a little more? Yeah, I think we better.
Frank kills Lady Tanaka. He puts a knife in her neck. And they save the kid. Then Franco decides, because he remembers that the Punisher said that after this he was going to kill him, he turns the gun on Frank Castle and says, you helped me with my son, I respect you, but you said you were going to kill me, so now I have to kill you. But the Punisher, as he does, he turns the tables on Franco and then kills him right in front of his son.
Kills him right in front of his son. And this leads to what might be my favorite part of the movie. Because, well, first we get a scene where Tommy, who's the kid, picks up the gun and he says, I'm going to kill you. And Frank's like, that's fine. Do it. Like, get it out of your system now so you won't be a shitty dude like your dad. Which is a hard ass thing to tell someone who just watched his father die, but also is a very Frank Castle thing to tell someone.
Someone who is like, also, yeah, like, maybe 11 years old.
Yeah, a fucking 10-year-old. Like, and then, but Tommy can't do it. Like, Tommy can't pull the trigger. And Dolph Lundgren's last line in the movie, which is, like, honest to God, the movie goes on for a couple minutes, but it should have ended here, is Dolph Lundgren saying, you're a good boy, Tommy. Grow up to be a good man. Because if not, I'll be waiting. Which is fucking rad.
And super Punisher, right? Like,
super Punisher.
Because, you know, this is a guy who has probably seen kids grow up to become shitty mobsters, right?
Oh, yeah. There are, like, I'm sure Frank's probably killed a lot of dudes' kids who have come back for revenge.
Lou Gossett, who was used as leverage to get the Punisher to agree to save Franco's son. Like, they kidnapped Lou Gossett, who had resigned from the force, who is suddenly just a cop again. Like, I guess he took back his resignation, because by the end of the movie, he shows up with the state police and sees all these dead, you know, Yakuza members. And it's like, ah, it had to be Frank. And the last shot of Lou Gossett is him out on near the top of this skyscraper, screaming out into the city, Frank! Frank! And then we see Dolph Lundgren back in his sewer lair, and through voiceover he says that he will be waiting in the shadows, serving his own brand of justice. All right, Chris, let's talk high points of The Punisher 1989.
Honestly, we've talked about it before, but I think this movie does hit that sweet spot. It doesn't do what Daredevil Season 2 does, which is puts the Punisher into his context as being in a superhero universe. You know, Daredevil, Jessica Jones, the Netflix shows, they do exist in the same universe as the Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy. So Punisher does feel like something different in that. I think that's a thing the show does a really good job of. The other two movies didn't. They tried to be more straightforward action movies. This movie hits the sweet spot of maybe not existing in a superhero universe, but existing in a weird universe. A weird ride your motorcycle through the sewers to go fight dudes on Coney Island amusement park rides universe. That kind of over-the-top weirdness. Like, fucking ninjas slide down a slide with Uzis in this movie, and I love that. I think that's great.
There are Yakuza enforcers, henchmen, whatever guys, who attack the Italian mobsters at the dock in scuba gear. They're wearing wetsuits. Yeah. And they're throwing
fucking ninjas.
They're throwing like ninja stars at guys.
it's very comic booky in a way that, you know, again, I've read the reaction to this in the letters pages. Like, I don't think that the people who saw this movie in 1991 wanted this movie to be like that, but I don't know what those people wanted. Like, I, you know, I had the conversation with Glenn Weldon about the reaction in fanzines when the Batman TV show came on, and people were like, no, this is too campy, this is too silly, this isn't my Batman. And I don't know what, like, he says, I don't know what Batman existed in their heads, because it was adaptations of the comics that were running at the time. And I feel that way with The Punisher. Like, this is, you know, 90% a straightforward adaptation of those first 50 issues of The Punisher.
I mean, I think
it's maybe a little more toned down.
Yeah, I think a big part of it might just be he doesn't have the skull on his chest. Like, I think that's a hard hurdle for some people to get over. But at the same time, it's kind of – it's not a big movie. It's not intended to be a big movie. It's intended to be kind of like, you know, a VHS action movie, right? Like, it's not a big origin story. It's not like a really personal story for the Punisher or for Frank Castle. It's the Punisher getting involved in a conflict between two crime organizations, right? So – it feels like it's not a big story, but for people who think that that's a liability, I see that as being to this movie's credit in hindsight. I think it makes this movie better because not only does it feel like a Punisher story from the comics to a T,
mm-hmm.
it also plays to the strengths of the movie. Because I don't know, I feel like Dolph Lundgren pulls this off pretty well. He's got the look. He's got, you know, he can believably stand on a craps table and shoot slot machines for a long time. But I don't know if he was to be called on to do like an emotional arc for Frank Castle, the character, that it would be something that he would be super capable of doing, you know?
Yeah, like, I do think – I think maybe it's the time, because he does – like we said, he does kind of feel like the Ennis Punisher, like, in terms of go ahead and shoot me in the head, 10-year-old kid, if that is what you want to do. Also, be good or I will murder you.
Well, it's he's also doing stuff that I would expect to see in a Garth Ennis Punisher story, like saving kids who are going to be sold into slavery.
It's a Garth Ennis Punisher in a Mike Baron world, which is, like, kind of exactly what I want. And, you know, you talked about Lundgren, and for all of his difficulties acting, like, for all of, you know, for the fact that the voice is a little weird, and he seems, you know, very, very reserved in a way that I actually find appealing for the character, like, he does look like the Punisher. Like, he doesn't look like the modern Punisher, but he looks pretty much exactly like that Klaus Janson, Larry Stroman, Eric Larson Punisher.
Yeah.
Like, he has that look. He doesn't have Steve Dillon's Judge Dredd scowl, but he does look like go back and flip through those early Klaus Janson issues of the first ongoing series. And, you know, that is what he looks like. He doesn't look like the Mike Zeck Punisher, but, like, no one looks like the Mike Zeck Punisher.
I mean, Lou Gossett Jr. is also great in this movie.
Yeah.
He's the character who has to emote the most, I think, and he does a great job of it. One scene that we didn't mention, but he also gets to be a badass. Like, one scene that we didn't mention is as the Punisher and Franco are killing Yakuza members left and right, he's being held captive, Jake Berkowitz is, by the Mafia. And Jake Berkowitz gets out of being held captive by the Mafia just by saying he has to go to the bathroom, then saying, like, hey, buddy, are you going to hold my dick while I pee, or can I do it? So he gets the guy who's holding him captive to take him out of his handcuffs, and then he asks the guy, do you have to take an IQ test to get this job? And the guy goes, no, and then he just knocks him the fuck out. Then he starts walking out of that, like, mega 80s boardroom. Another mobster guy shows up with a box, a pizza box. And he goes, hey, I brought the pizza. And Lou Gossett knocks that guy out, knocks the pizza out of his hand, then picks up a piece of pizza and eats it. And that is rad. That whole thing is rad.
Low points.
Yeah, what are some of our low points of the movie? I think one thing that I would consider to be maybe a little bit of a low point is that there are times where the movie seems a little disjointed. Like, it doesn't flow from one story point to another very super well.
It feels very episodic and like you said, very set piece oriented.
Yeah, it's weird to me that this movie was directed by someone who is largely known as an editor, because it feels kind of thrown together in a weird way, which, you know, sort of actually adds to its appeal maybe as a VHS movie. But
yeah,
the conflict between the mob and the Yakuza doesn't feel as organic or like as well thought out or as well explained as it should be.
I think the biggest problem with this movie, in terms of its appeal to fandom, maybe, is that it looks cheap. It looks cheap and feels kind of cheap. And it's very easy for us in 2016 as two guys who very clearly have a love of, you know, have nostalgia for going back and you know, going to Blockbuster Video and walking down the action movie aisle. It's very easy for us to overlook that and forgive that, but it does certainly seem cheap.
I mean,
in the way it comes off.
That's a low point in 1991, I guess. It's a high
point.
It's
certainly not a low point today. Yeah, I think that adds so much appeal.
I love that aesthetic of the movie. I love that it looks that way and feels that way and feels like it, you know, a VHS movie, you know? I don't think that that's a downfall of the movie at all. I do think that some of the acting is almost like sub-TV level.
Yeah, I mean, that the bad guy, whose name I forget, but for being a dude who has a lot of work, is not good. He is not really bringing it in this.
Likewise, Kim Maiori, I believe is her name, the actress who plays Lady Tanaka, just kind of sleepwalks through it.
She's okay. Like, I think she does a pretty decent job of playing the role, and I think part of that is that I like the idea of, you know, this movie being about a beautiful and intelligent and ruthless older woman fighting the Punisher. You know, if it wasn't for the scene where she is literally dressed as a geisha, I think she would come off as like a really cool character that, again, seems more like something you'd see in 2005 than in 1991 or 1989.
She's kind of Ma Nucci, right?
Yeah.
She's like the Japanese version of Ma Nucci, which is, again, another way that this is like the Garth Ennis Punisher. And in a weird way, this movie sort of presages the Garth Ennis run on Punisher. At the same time, I don't think the actress who plays Berkowitz's partner is all that great. She's just kind of there.
And she does have one amazing line, which in retrospect is really terrible. Like when she introduces herself to Berkowitz, she's like, "Yeah, you know, I worked with you on that sting." And then he's like, "Yeah, I don't remember you." And then she very proudly goes, "I was the prostitute."
Yeah.
Which is a funny gag, but like it's a weird introduction to the character.
I mean, she's proud of her undercover work. That's fine.
Yeah.
And then Shake feels like he's from a whole fucking other movie. The performance and the way that he's presented, I feel like Shake needed to be toned down a lot. Considering how toned down the Punisher is and how sort of low-key even the bad guys are, Shake being so theatrical. And I know that that's his character, but he just feels so out of place.
Yeah, he, like, again, I think that's another strike against it that people would have railed against in the early 90s, which is that the Punisher does not need a rhyming sidekick who he has to lure out of a bar with a remote control car with a bottle of booze on it.
That's
a thing
great,
that happens
though.
In this.
That part's pretty great, though. I mean, kind of love that.
Great, But it's also like, why does the Punisher have a little remote control car with a bottle of bourbon on it? That's bananas.
I think that all fits into what I might call tone problems.
Yeah. There's a couple of tone problems.
A little bit in the way of tone problems. All right. What are our final thoughts about 1989's The Punisher?
I went and looked. You know, I told you that I've seen a lot of stuff in the letter column, so I went and looked. And one that I found, you know, off the top of my head here was in Punisher number 48, which came out in shortly before the movie would have been released direct-to-video here in America. And it's from John D. Vasquez, who lives in Puerto Rico. And he says, "Dear Punishing Males," that was the name of the letter column, "I've heard lots of comments about the Punisher movie. Well, here's the real truth. It was released in theaters in Puerto Rico in the spring of 1990. I saw it and it was great. Dolph Lundgren is a great Frank Castle. The plot was good and the action sequences were incredible. Till Punisher finishes punishing, make mine Marvel." So at least one fan was super into this movie. And I think, like, I agree. The action sequences in this movie are great, and Dolph Lundgren is a surprisingly good Frank Castle.
Speaking of reviews of the movie, the movie got mostly bad reviews. And a lot of the bad reviews were about how the things we talked about. It looks cheap. The fight sequences are maybe a little goofy. And the acting is bad. But TV Guide gave the movie 3 out of 4 stars. And in it, they called the movie's atmosphere genuinely comic book-like rather than cartoonish. And I think that is exactly right.
Yeah, I think that is the way to put it.
Like, aside from the F-bombs that this movie is full of, aside from the R-rated stuff in this movie, it could easily be, you know, the story, a comic book story arc for the Punisher. Even down to the, like, amount of origin stuff you get, right? Where it's just like, hey, here's a quick reminder if you're jumping onto this series with issue 36. The Punisher is the Punisher because his family died. All right, now on with the story, you know?
Yeah.
It has that feel very, like, it's very well done in that regard. It doesn't make the story bigger than it has to be because it's a movie. Which I think might be the downfall of the other Punisher movies. They feel like they have to have big movie stories.
Yeah, I it's something that, that interview that I did with Glenn Weldon is fresh on my mind because it just happened. But he talks about how when they made Batman 89, same year that they made this, they have to cram Batman into the 3-act movie structure. So, you know, something that happens in the first act has to come back in the third act. And that's why you get the Joker killing Batman's parents and Batman killing the Joker. That's weird. That doesn't work for me, at least. I know people, they're big fans of that movie out there. But for me, like, that doesn't work. In a way that this movie keeps everything small, makes a couple of minor adjustments to the origin that, you know, that might be like, oh, Dolph Lundgren is too young to have served in Vietnam at this point. Like, maybe are drawn from that rather than anything else. But I think that it works by keeping it small. So...
And frankly, this movie has a 3-act structure, but the 3 acts are like 3 issues of a comic book. The first act sets up the conflict between the two crime families and has some conflict there, has things setting off between them, and ends and results in kids being kidnapped. The second act is the Punisher saving the kids, and the third act is the Punisher being called in to help one of the rival mob bosses. That's like 3 issues of a 3-issue story arc.
There's very little that would prevent this movie from just being, you know, taking place between Punisher 35 and Punisher 36, you know? But again, it doesn't give you anything new. So if you're looking to see something new out of the Punisher, this is a story that is familiar, is the nicest way to put that. But I think it's fun. If you've never seen this movie, I would recommend it because it's just bonkers enough to be entertaining, but doesn't get out of – you never think like, oh, that's not Frank Castle.
I had more moments of – I don't know if this is the Punisher in Daredevil season 2 than in this movie.
Yeah, there's a couple.
Because Daredevil season 2 has the Punisher shooting wildly through a hospital.
Well, as he says later in the series, nobody got hurt that didn't deserve it. So yeah, I think he is.
He says that shooting. He says that in this movie too, where he's like, "I only punish the guilty," right? And that is pitch perfect Punisher characterization. It gets him right if it does nothing else right. I think that does it for this episode of Movie Fighters. Thank you for listening. Our music is by Michael Kill, except for our snack situation theme, which is by our friend Matt Fisher. Our website was designed by Sean Bogus. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another movie. We may do another Dolph Lundgren movie if there's demand for it, or we may move on to just doing straight up canon films. Either way, we'll be back in 2 weeks with one of those. See you soon.
Keep on fighting the movies.
This has been a Kleitas Media production.